From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And in about 2 hours, the Federal Reserve is expected to announce it is raising short-term interest rates for just the second time since 2006. Economists predict the Fed, led by Chair Janet Yellen, will move rates up about 0.25%. And joining us now is Diane Swonk, founder of DS Economics. She's in Chicago. Diane, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And what are you expecting to hear from the Fed today?
Well, I think we'll hear certainly that the Fed raises rates, and I think we're going to hear some dissonance within the Fed in terms of how they think about rate hikes going forward. Many hawks in the Fed are looking at the pipeline inflation that we saw come out today, and they're going to be a little worried about how much inflation is in the pipeline, especially given what they are concerned about is what kind of policies we get from the new administration. That said, the elephant in the room is the new administration. The Fed doesn't take into account different political scenarios. So what we'll see is the dispersion in the infamous dot forecast in terms of how people think about rate hikes. But hawks have been a little nervous as it is. And now that we've seen this extraordinary rally in equity markets, they're also going to be concerned about not only inflation picking up more rapidly than they'd like, although they want to reflate the economy, they're also worried about asset price bubbles.
And when you talk about pipeline inflation, by the way, what are you talking about? Are you seeing signs that inflation is on the way?
Basically, what we're seeing is in what we call the producer price index, which has many components to it, we saw a surge, particularly in service sector inflation. And ironically, this is an area where consumers, it doesn't show up in the retail sales data because that data doesn't include services like taking plane trips and, staying at hotels. But that is what surged in the month of November. And in fact, that's where inflation picked up as well in terms of where pricing power picked up. And that's something that we should watch because it's also an area where you don't see a lot of cheap imports, so you're not going to get that offset from cheaper imports coming in.
At last check, according to the Labor Department, the unemployment rate was at 4.6%. Is that about as good as it's going to get, or do you feel that the economy is operating at full capacity?
It's actually, I think what we're going to see is, more importantly than the overall unemployment rate, the Fed is still committed, and certainly the Yellen Fed, and I think it's very important to clarify that now, she's still got more than a year in office, and I think she will stay her full term, is committed to not just bringing down the overall unemployment rate, but that sort of stress measure of unemployment, we call it the U6 measure, which is still very elevated relative to the pre-crisis levels. It's running about 9.3%. Before the crisis, it was almost 1% below that, and so they really want to whittle away at those people who have been marginalized by the crisis and re-engage some of the workers who are still on the sidelines, which means overshooting on the overall unemployment rate on the downside.
Are there any economists out there who are saying that rates should stay where they are, that they shouldn't go up today?
There are some very few out there that are arguing that. And I think, the issue is, how much you want to sort of allow inflation to overshoot. There are many who would like to see further overshooting of inflation. At the end of the day, they're in the minority, and I think the sense is that the Fed may be a little bit behind the curve on rate hikes, which is exactly where the Fed actually wants to be at this stage of the game. They don't want to take the punch away from the party. They still want to leave a little room for people to sort of have a little bit more dance space and bring more people on the dancing floor.
And what do you expect the impacts will be on consumers of a rate hike? We've been talking about maybe mortgage rates ticking up and maybe credit card rates ticking up and student loan rates and other things. But what are you expecting?
Well, we've already seen the pickup in mortgage rates, which has been fairly dramatic, and we actually have seen a fairly sharp reaction by consumers instead of just jumping in and trying to lock in rates, which they often do when rates go up. The mortgage applications, which came out again today, declined for purchases. So we've got a pipeline of some strong housing sales going forward, but the purchase applications are now going down, which have a lag on them several months out, but it suggests that we actually are seeing a reaction that even small increases in rates from a low level do have an outsized impact on consumer behavior.
We've been living in kind of an extraordinary situation over the last many years since the financial crisis of these very low interest rates near zero. Do you expect that now we're going to get into a period where the Fed raises them many times per year?
Well, many times per year is more than once, given we've only gotten once a year Yellen
right.
for the last 2 years. So I think we easily could see 3 rate hikes this year. That is 3 times as many as we had, in 2017 as we had in 2016 or 2015. It's not exactly an extraordinary hike in rates.
Do you expect Yellen to stay on? I know this is far away, but under Trump when her term is up?
When her term is up, I expect her to leave. I think that Trump will want to appoint his own Federal Reserve chair. And the people they're talking about appointing to Fed governor positions would be people who would combat her fairly dramatically. And, you know, someone that's in the position of Federal Reserve chair, as they get more and more people that are hostile on the board to their way of thinking, they certainly don't want to stick around because they lose their ability to influence the decision of the key members of the board.
That's Diane Swank, the founder of Diane Swank Economics in Chicago. Diane, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, to Aleppo, Syria now, where there had been a ceasefire ahead of what was assumed would soon be the fall of the rebel-held eastern part of the city to forces loyal to Bashar al-Assad. But fighting has resumed, trapping tens of thousands of civilians in East Aleppo before they could evacuate. The carnage from the government forces on the ground is reportedly unspeakable. Yesterday, Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., told the U.N. Security Council that the Syrian government, along with its allies, Russia and Iran, bears responsibility for the slaughter of civilians.
Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you? Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit? Is there nothing you will not lie about or justify?
NPR's Allison Muse is in Beirut. She's been talking to people on the ground in Aleppo. Allison, what are they saying?
People on the ground in those last rebel-held districts say shelling attacks have resumed, and so have airstrikes. At dawn today, people had gathered to evacuate in the rain with whatever life possessions they could carry, and then they heard the deal had hit a snag. One man I've been speaking to says the bombing is back to the way it was before, and maybe even worse. This isn't happening in a vacuum, rights monitors and Syrian state media say rebels have also resumed shelling on the government side. And on both sides, you have a heavy concentration of people who've been recently displaced. So civilians are really paying the highest price for this resumption of hostilities.
Now, well, what happened to the ceasefire? It was announced yesterday by Turkey, Russia, which, of course, is backing Syrian forces. And it was announced by the Syrian rebels. So what happened?
It's not completely clear, but opposition activists say an Iranian-backed militia stopped the evacuation. They want victims from their side evacuated from two pro-government villages in northern Syria, which are besieged by rebels. I spoke to a contact who has relatives trapped in those villages, and he described an awful situation, that rebels have upped shelling attacks and his family members even fled their house because it was a target. And the injured there can't be evacuated either because of a deal with another area besieged by the regime. So you can see how complicated these deals get. And with all these warring parties and their backers, it's so easy for politics and military strategy to take over and civilian lives to kind of hang in the balance. And people are still hoping this will go through. They had prepared to leave, packed their possessions, videotaped goodbye videos, and now everyone's kind of in a holding pattern.
Yeah. Well, and you remind us that Iran is also joining Russia in backing Assad's forces and Assad. So what are civilians hoping for? We understand, you know, there are bodies in the streets that the white helmet volunteer rescuers can't even keep up with the carnage. What are civilians hoping for?
As we know, there's thousands, tens of thousands of people believed to be trapped there, and they have been living in a siege in the recent period. So, as you said, they have very little supplies to care for the wounded, and it's a desperate situation. So despite the fact that nobody wants to leave home, they do want to live, and they are hoping, according to people I talked to, for this evacuation to go forward, and the UN and the international community are certainly calling for that.
Yeah. Well, and remind us, you know, we all know or should know what Aleppo is now, but remind us why it's so important in the bigger picture, how much of the country is rebel versus government controlled when it comes to the Syrian civil war, because we also know that ISIS is involved battling the Syrian government. So give us the bigger picture.
Aleppo is important because it's the last major city where the rebels really had a strong foothold. And the rebel losses in recent weeks have been stunning. It's a big turnaround for the Assad regime, which had vowed to take the city back by force and indeed seems set on doing that, even if an evacuation is agreed last minute. And for the rebellion, the beginning of a very different phase. If they evacuate, where will they go? They will go either to Idlib province, where very hardline rebel groups dominate, and the West may be unlikely to give strong backing, or at least backing that would allow them to turn the tables. And if they go to northern Aleppo countryside, the Turkish operations there are focused on ISIS and preventing a Kurdish autonomous state on their border. So this is a very different goal than these people took to the streets for in 2011.
That's NPR's Allison Mews in Beirut following the fighting in Aleppo. Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
You probably know that South African comic Trevor Noah replaced Jon Stewart as host of The Daily Show last year, big shoes to fill. You may not know that Trevor was born to a black South African mother and a Swiss-German dad during apartheid. He was born a crime. He was illegal. His black mom had to hire a fake mom to walk with him to the park. His real mom would walk behind. He couldn't call his white father dad in public the few times he did see him. They'd all be arrested. He was often hidden in his home in black ghettos. Well, now Trevor Noah is talking to the President of the United States. Here he is in their hour-long interview this week.
This is a personal question. It's a little bit selfish. I look up to you because we share a lot in common. We both have parents who are black and white, both half African, south side of Chicago, south side of Africa.
Similar.
In Trevor Noah's new biography, Born a Crime, he tells how he and his mom, a typist, survived poverty at times so bad they ate caterpillars, and violence. His drunken stepdad shot his mom. Incredibly, she lived. Trevor was a bit of a scamp. He got away with things because he didn't know how much black South Africans were afraid of or held in awe his mixed race whiteness. And Trevor Noah joins us from the Daily Show studio in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Well, you had me in the first few minutes of the book. Your mom threw you out of a car. In fact, to explain why you hate secondhand cars, I'm just going to read a little bit. We're only on page 9. If it hadn't been for the Volkswagen that didn't work, you never would have looked for the mechanic who became the husband, who became the stepfather, who became the man who tortured us, you and your mom, for years, and put a bullet in the back of my mother's head. I'll take the new car with the warranty every time. And it's that combination we see throughout the book of very serious with levity. Is that how you made it through your life?
Well, I don't know, because, I mean, I haven't made it through yet. So, yeah, it's how I've always processed information. It's how I've processed pain. It's how I work through any issues that face me in life.
Well, place us in time. During apartheid, a white population, a black population, but then also a colored population.
Basically, in South Africa, the apartheid laws were very specific in the separation of races. And even amongst black people, you would be designated a certain tribal group that you were forced to live with. And so now you have to make rules about what constitutes black and white. And colored was a strange decision that the government came up with, where they realized this population was growing, which meant people were clearly breaking these laws. Did you add them to the majority that you were trying to oppress? Or did you designate an entirely different race? And that's what the government did. And for all intents and purposes, colored people have become a culture unto themselves in South Africa.
Well, and what did that mean for you? What were you?
Well, I grew up as black. You know, I mean, the country or the government itself would have classified me as colored because everyone was classified. The government would have called me colored. I would have been deemed colored on my birth certificate were it not for the fact that my mother lied about who my father was and where I was from. I grew up in a country where there were white people who would be, demoted by the government based on the fact that their whiteness had changed, whether people's hair became too curly or their skin became too tanned. It was an insane system. Mm. And I grew up as a black child. I knew no other existence.
Except it wasn't the same life that a black child had. And you talk about how in interacting with other people, for instance, when all the grandmas would like whoop some kids because they'd done something wrong, they were afraid to whoop you because you were white and you might bruise.
Yeah, well, I guess that's where you realize, I mean, in hindsight, as a child, I didn't know why this was happening. I just assumed that it was because I was special as Trevor. You know, I didn't grow up in a world where I was conscious of the fact that I was of a different race. I knew that I was of a different color, but race wasn't something I had been taught about yet. My grandparents were victims of a system that had trained them and indoctrinated into them the belief that they themselves weren't of the same standing as a lighter-skinned person.
Yeah, just so interesting how, as a child, you try to navigate this. With your mother as your guide, tell us about your mother.
My mother was an amazing woman, someone who did not live an easy life at all. She experienced the lowest trenches of poverty, and she worked very hard to raise herself up out of that place through a combination of hard work, determination, and luck, or as she would call it, blessings. She learned to read and write at a mission school. My mother decided to go into jobs and to get training that really no person could use because of the jobs that black people weren't allowed into. And yet when the country changed, all of a sudden there was a skills shortage, and my mother was able to take advantage of that. So she was a person who constantly believed in existing beyond the threshold of where people told her she belonged.
She was fierce.
My mom was very harsh on me, and she always used to say, she'd say, I would rather that you hate me. I would rather be the person who disciplines you, because I discipline you with love. The police out there are not going to be your friend. And that was a motto that many South African mothers have, many black mothers have.
Well, this brings us back to mom throwing you out of the car, out of the moving car. It was because, if I've got this right, you were picked up by a Zulu driver, and he saw that she was a black woman with you, a colored child, immediately thought that, you know, she had been with a white man and was going to punish her. And she realized this as you were driving along.
That story in that instance is specific, but I believe at the end of the day we were unlucky in that we came across a man who had the intention of, you know, sexually assaulting or my mother in that instance. And the
right.
excuse this person used in this instance was that my mother was a whore who sleeps with white men. She reacted the way she always reacted in life, and that was to put herself on the line and get us to safety. And that was the world we were living in.
So she wakes you up, says jump. You jump out of the moving car. By then you also have your baby brother, Andrew. And, you know, there's this scene where, you know, my heart's pounding. What's going to happen here? And suddenly there you are. She breaks out in a huge smile and starts laughing. I started laughing too. We stood there, this little boy and his mom, our arms and legs covered in blood and dirt, laughing together through the pain on the side of the road in the middle of the night. Again, this sort of danger and fear and laughter.
Well, that's life, isn't it? I feel like that's exactly what life is. We have moments of pain. We have moments where we're afraid. But laughter is always the thing that can bring us back to the place we wish we were always in. It is a moment of solace.
Well, some of the stops along the way for you, you steal a car from your stepdad and get pulled over, and there's a week in jail there. You become sort of a mixtape DJ. You're starting to gain a reputation, and you go to play at, I believe it was a Jewish school, and one of your best dancers, his name is Hitler.
Yeah, well, it's an insane world. I mean, I'm still friends with Hitler today, which is a crazy statement to say living
sentence.
In a Western world, but when I met him, I mean, I knew of the historical context of his name, but never the gravity of the name and what it stood for or what people took from it in many other places. Because as I talk about in the book, I grew up in a world where there were so many madmen who had in some way affected our world.
We should explain that you were your people were made to take names in addition to the names they were born with. So they would just take names from the newspapers.
Essentially, that's a vestige of colonialism.
Right.
They forced them to take names which were Christian names, as they called them, or your English name.
And he had a wonderful moment dancing at this Jewish school when suddenly the teachers, the parents, the hundreds of kids in their yarmulkes froze in their tracks and stared aghast at you cheering, "Go Hitler, go Hitler."
It was a horrifying,
horrifying
moment, but a great moment in the book. It
was.
I keep looking back and going, that must have been one of the most horrifying moments those people have ever gone through. I think if anything, the essence of that story and me telling that, you know, that tale was trying to illuminate how easy it is to be completely blind to the possibility that a human being could be living a life absolutely different to yours.
Those were two very different cultures. But even within the black culture in South Africa, there were so many different cultures within one culture. And one of the ways you made your way, and I'm guessing learned some of your skills today at sort of hearing people and listening to people, is by learning all these different languages. Can you call some of them up now? Are they as fluid for you now as they were when you were a child?
Yeah, easily. I still speak all of my African languages. The only language that I've gotten really rusty on is my German, because I don't have many people to speak it to. But, you know, I'm proud that I can, and I celebrate African languages because it goes beyond just my home. It is a culture, and it is a people, and it is a memory that I have and that we have as a nation that I would never want to forget.
Can we hear some Zulu or some Xhosa?
Some Xhosa I'll give you real quick. This is like one of my mom's favorite phrases. She'd say, which means I will smack you upside the head, you delinquent child. You have no respect for me.
How about, is it Tswana?
Tswana is slightly different. It would be, you know, you'd say to somebody, Dumelang libitso laka ke Trevor Noah. So that's, hello, my name is Trevor Noah.
How many did you speak?
I speak 6 languages.
Zulu?
Ngiyajabula, Robin. Ukuba lapho now gu NPR. Ngiyajabula. Ukukhuluma nawe. Isikhathi sakho. Ngiyajabula ukuba nawe la gule show yakho. I appreciate being here on your show with you.
Well, we loved hearing that. Well, it is just a terrific book, Trevor Noah. We would love to have you back to hear about the next passage, you know, how you went from this life you describe in South Africa to the one that we see now. We'll do that another time.
But thank you so much. I appreciate that.
It's just terrific. Trevor Noah, host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central, author of the new memoir, Born a Crime. Trevor, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And imagine working for 5 years on scientific or medical research, submitting it to the appropriate journal for publication, and having it rejected, only to find later that someone who reviewed your research stole it, published it under their name. Ivan Oransky wrote about such a case for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Ivan's also the co-founder of Retraction Watch, which tracks retractions in science journals. So, Ivan, how did this doctor, Michael Danziger, find out his research on metabolism diet had been stolen?
He actually read it in the journal that eventually published it. So in other words, someone had actually gone, as you said, and reviewed it, stolen it, gussied it up to make it look as though maybe it wasn't really Danziger's, and published it in really what I would consider a very low-ranked journal. The original journal that Danziger had hoped to publish this in was actually one of the top 5 or 6 medical journals in the world.
Yeah. Well, these were Italian researchers. The copied paper was retracted. The researchers who stole it acknowledged they did, apologized in a letter. But how else would you keep this from happening? We know that papers get published. There's peer review. Explain what the process is all about. I mean, I think if I were an Italian researcher and I published a paper, what if somebody called me up and said, I'd love to come see your lab? You know, maybe you haven't done it. So what are some other safeguards that can be put in place, and tell us more about what this process is supposed to be?
So what peer review means is that, you know, I submit a paper to a journal, and rather than just being able to publish it on my website and saying, oh, look at this, I found the best thing since sliced bread, someone else, a peer, or actually in this case usually 2 or 3 peers, is supposed to look over that. Does it make sense? Does it seem like I did the work that I'm claiming that I did? All of those things. That's all done, though, really secretly. So you know what's happening, but the editor is the only person who knows who's actually reviewing this paper and reading it. That's the typical process. What happened here was sort of the worst fear of a lot of researchers, which is that while your paper is being reviewed, it's not been published and nobody knows you've done it except that reviewer. So it's as if you had a big scoop and you sent it to me to, you know, just get a sense of, well, do you think this is legitimate? Should I run with this story? And then instead of actually giving you the feedback you wanted and helping you to make it maybe a better story, I went and stole it and I presented it as if I had published it. And so if this secrecy is taken away, that's one potential way that you might be able to prevent this sort of thing happening in the future.
Well, but you know, this happens in the film world. People steal manuscripts and make the films. But this is research. This is medical research. It feels it would be so easy to show that you, Dr. A, did all this lab work to come to this conclusion and the doctor who stole it didn't. I mean, does this really happen a lot?
You know, we don't know exactly how often it happens, but we've seen other cases of it. People talk about it. Somebody actually at our stat column left a comment to the effect that this was actually in a Kingsley Amis novel, I think 1954, and I don't think that was sort of the first time anyone had thought of it. You know, the fact is that the incentives in science often, I would say, promote kind of bad behavior, whether it's theft, out-and-out theft, or just sort of sloppiness, or just rushing to try and get things done. But you can imagine here where this person, the person who stole the work, maybe didn't even want anyone except someone reading his CV very quickly to actually see that he had published it. Because then you can hide it. You know, you can, it's like burying something in paperwork.
Yeah. Ivan Wierenski, a columnist with our partners at STAT, co-founder of Retraction Watch. They look for journals that retract papers. Ivan, thanks so much for talking to us about this case.
My pleasure. Thanks for being here, Robin.
Well, let's take a few minutes now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Aaron Bird is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. He is back with us once again. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, man. How's it going?
It's going well as we wrap up the year here. I think this is the last kind of non-themed DJ sessions that we will be doing this year because we're going to be looking at some Christmas music and then we're going to be looking at some of the best songs of the year. But with you, we've got the good old-fashioned DJ sessions. And starting with somebody that a lot of people probably know from TV, Donald Glover, who also in music goes by the name Childish Gambino. This is called Zombies. You know, there is so much talent with this guy, but USA Today sums it up this way, his album. They say it's groundbreaking and genre-defying at best, and at worst sounds like the teenage stoner down the block who just discovered his dad's Jimi Hendrix collection. Your thoughts?
I think that's pretty accurate. I think I would say if Funkadelic and Sly Family Stone had a child, it would be this album, Awaken My Love, with a, you know, a dash of Rick James and a sprinkle of Prince in there.
Hmm. Well, tell us more about this song, Zombies, and Childish Gambino in general.
Well, I guess I'll start off with the song. It's called Zombies because essentially he's referencing people who I guess he would term as being soulless. Folks that surround people who are successful individuals and just leech off of their success. You hear, I think it's in the first or second chorus, he says, all I see is zombies. I hear them screaming at her. They can smell your money and they want your soul. I think this really just sort of defines what the song is all about. Hmm. I would say Donald Glover in general, he is just a phenomenal talent. I mean, he's an actor, a producer, creator of the television series Atlanta, right, in which he actually just won the Critics' Choice Award for Best Actor.
And it's nominated for at least a couple of Golden Globes.
That's right. I forgot to mention that as well. And he's a comedian. In fact, he was handpicked by Tina Fey to write for 30 Rock.
Right.
So this guy is just a jack of all trades.
All right. Well, up next, we've got the Brooklyn artist Gabriel Garzon Montano. This is called The Game. I really like that.
It's hard not to. Yeah. I'm really, really excited by this guy. He's only been out for a couple of years. I remember he came out with an EP early 2014, and I've just been infatuated and really excited by him ever since. He's a native New Yorker, and he actually comes from a musical family. His mother was a classically trained singer and was actually a part of the Philip Glass Ensemble.
Hmm.
He himself has been playing violin since he was six, and though he's set that instrument down, he plays drums and bass, keys, guitars, and sings. In fact, that EP I was just referencing, he plays every single instrument and wrote all the music for it. He's toured, opening up for Lenny Kravitz. He's actually now Grammy nominated because one of the songs from that very same EP, Drake sampled for one of his tunes in which he was nominated for. And he's just a fantastic talent. And you can hear the sort of D'Angelo influence, a nice, cool soul vibe to it with a little bit of pop sensibility. And I think there's a lot to come from this cat.
All right. Well, the next one you wanted us to hear is Lee Fields and the Expressions. This is Never Be Another You.
And oh, it makes me happy when I see you happy. I get such a thrill when I see you smile. And oh, being close to you, make all my dreams come true. There will never be another you. There will never be another you. There will never be another you. You're one of a kind.
What a great song, and I recognize it probably because I've been listening to the KCRW app and maybe even to your show, Aaron, and have heard it. But tell us about this one.
Yeah, Lee Fields, well, he's been recording, believe it or not, for over 43 years. Many people make the comparison to Charles Bradley, whom you may be familiar with, and also a KCRW favorite. They both embody that funk and soul of the 60s and 70s, in particular the James Brown recordings during those decades. In fact, Lee Fields himself is sometimes referred to as Little JB because of his vocal resemblance to James Brown. He actually voiced some of James Brown's songs, or I should say sang some of James Brown's songs as part of that biopic that came out a couple of years ago, Get On Up, if I recall. And so that's how much he resembles James Brown. And this song in particular, I mean, it's just a classic, baby, you're one of a kind, I'm so in love with you kind of deal. You know, we can never have enough of those. And it's just an incredible full length. And I think, I mean, it came out towards the latter part of the year, so maybe crept under the radar of some people's on their top 10 list of 2016. But this is one of the better releases of this year, I would say.
Yeah, it's just a great sound and a great song. And you're right, it does sound like it's something that James Brown would have done. Let's get to the last one here, Aaron. This is Suso, and it's called Son Kunda. You've taken us in a very different direction here, and I understand that some of the sounds we're hearing were recorded during a trip to Gambia.
That's right. So Suso is a project by bassist and producer Hugh Bennett, and it was inspired by, and in certain instances, as you mentioned, sample sounds of the specifically Mandinka people of Gambia. So he originally embarked on this trip just to gain some perspective as a musician and discover some new music he was unfamiliar with. He was completely humbled and charmed by how welcomed he was by the community of artists and musicians there, in particular, those belonging to the highly praised Suso and Koyeta Griot families. And all the songs are original. The entire album is composed of, as you mentioned, field recordings and Bennett himself playing an array of regional instruments, including the Mandinka balafon, which is a wooden xylophone, and the Kuthering drum, and of course, as a bassist, him playing bass as well.
Well, quite a range from you today, Aaron.
You know, I always try to bring a variety of styles. And also, I mean, it's a, I feel like whenever we have these opportunities with the Here and Now sessions, it's also an opportunity for me to present my show. I go all over the place with my show. I'm actually surprised when people like it because it's like, man, I like some of everything. You like that too?
Well, Aaron Bird, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California, thanks so much as always for joining us.
Oh, Jeremy, thank you so much. And I suppose this is the last time until the new year. So happy holidays to you and yours, and be safe.
You as well, and happy new year. And, of course, people can find all of our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Donald Trump's inauguration next month will bring thousands of visitors to Washington, D.C. Airbnb says it expects more than 10,000 people will use its platform to book a place to stay. Many Airbnb hosts are raising their prices. Others are apprehensive. Michaela Lefrak from Here and Now contributor WAMU reports.
Walking into Cinta Keeling's house feels like a mix between a hip European hostel and visiting an old friend. The three-story townhouse in the southeast D.C. neighborhood of Capitol View is full of light, with brightly painted walls and bedspreads with bicycles printed on them.
Two beds here, and there's one bathroom. And that's my bedroom right there.
Keeling welcomes a lot of people into her home. She uses Airbnb to rent out her two spare bedrooms to dozens of visitors every year. But even though she's a popular host, she hasn't rented out for the night before inauguration just yet.
A lot of people were asking early on because they wanted to be a part of history, and I said to them, let's just wait.
Keeling lives in a majority black neighborhood. She supported Hillary Clinton and planned to put up her inauguration listing right after the election. But when Donald Trump won, she balked.
I was concerned about how they would treat my neighbors. You know, are they used to being in a majority-minority community? And are they going to have a reaction that would be discriminatory towards me? Because that's something that I have to be concerned about.
Keeling says she's talked to other hosts near her and found that many of them have decided to keep their doors closed during the inauguration. Some hosts are signaling their political leanings to prospective guests by posting pictures of Clinton or anti-Trump posters within their listings. There have been hard feelings about the election results, but Keeling says others are motivated by different worries.
People who are east of the river are concerned about people being disrespectful. People west of the river are looking at the money aspect of it.
And there may be lots of money to be made in the predominantly white neighborhoods west of the river. Airbnb's popularity has skyrocketed since the last presidential inauguration in 2013. The company says D.C. area hosts could earn more than $3.5 million over inauguration. Most of those earnings are expected to come from a handful of popular neighborhoods: Adams Morgan, Shaw, the H Street Corridor, and Columbia Heights.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
Ludmila Trigubova lives in a townhouse on Capitol Hill, walking distance from where President-elect Trump will take the oath of office.
Should I take off my shoes?
This is the house rule.
All right. She's rented her home on Airbnb for the previous two inaugurations and plans to do it for Donald Trump's.
I never talk about politics, never. Even if I ask to, I just make it light.
Trigubova says she's a moderate Republican, but had a blast hosting guests for President Obama's inaugurations. In 2009, she had 16 guests from around the world staying with her.
Everybody was united. Everybody was supportive, regardless of the crowd in the house.
The tone could be different this year, with thousands pledging to protest Donald Trump the day after the inauguration. Trigubova had a guest cancel her inauguration booking after Clinton lost. Airbnb spokesman Nick Pappas says that's part of a trend.
We definitely saw some cancellation the days following the election, but we also saw that bookings increased by 80% during the week following Election Day. So there's no question that many people were waiting to see how the election turned out before they made their plans.
Pappas says Airbnb will have extra staff on hand to address any issues that might come up. He also says his company sees itself as a technological bridge that can bring people together.
Been a divisive election, and there are folks with very strong views on both sides. But at the end of the day, we can bring folks together from different parties or different ideologies to break bread. We think that's a great thing.
Cinta Keeling feels the same way. She's the Airbnb host we met at the beginning of the story, who was hesitant about listing her home. She's changed her mind. Her doors are now open because she thinks it's a good opportunity to be inclusive.
It's one of the few intentional experiences that you can have to live with someone that's of a different background.
Keeling hasn't had any takers yet, but she's fully booked the next day. Her guests are anti-Trump protesters. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lefrak in Washington.
Well, as we close out this hour, we want to take a moment to remember Alan Thicke, who died of a heart attack yesterday at the age of 69. Thicke's biggest TV role was Jason Seaver, the supportive, reassuring dad on the ABC sitcom Growing Pains. Here's a scene with actor Kirk Cameron in 1987.
Mike, you're never going to be able to please everybody.
Yeah, well, tonight I didn't please anybody.
Except yourself.
Yeah.
Hey, what you did tonight took real courage, Mike. I admire you.
Thanks, Dad.
Well, in an interview just last week on CBC Radio's Q, Thicke said he felt at home with that character.
The role is close enough to how I would aspire to be. And I think I brought some of my own values, my good old Canadian Northern Ontario backwoods values. I think I brought some of that to the character. And in turn, I learned something from what they were writing.
Thicke was also a singer and songwriter who wrote some of the best-known themes from 1980s TV, including The Facts of Life and Different Strokes. Alan Thicke, again, was 69 years old. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. They got nothing but the